Girls in Afghanistan have it hard, unless they become boys.
This woman invited me to her house, and as I arrived, she had to take a phone call in the other room, and I spoke to her 10-year-old twin daughters, who spoke a little bit of English. And we had a very basic conversation going in terms of, you know, what's your favorite flower, what are you going to be when you grow up? And then all of a sudden, one of them says to me, and this is a 10-year-old girl, she says, "You know, our brother is really a girl."
That's investigative journalist Jenny Nordberg. We talk with her about her book, The Underground Girls of Kabul. It's about how some girls in Afghanistan are disguised as boys, an ancient practice in a gender unequal society. And the access to safe, legal abortions is under threat in America today. What does that mean for women's rights?
Without the right to control your body, you really don't have very many rights at all. At any moment, you can get pregnant, and then at that moment, your entire life is turned upside down.
That's feminist writer Katha Pollitt. She says abortion is a moral right and a social good. Her book is Pro. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Afghanistan just might be the worst place in the world to be born a girl, unless you become a bacha push. Those are young girls who are disguised as boys by their families to bypass the limitations that extreme gender oppression create. They may be working to help their family survive, serving as proof that their mother can bear sons, or being sent to school to get an education other girls are deprived of. The practice of bacha push is ancient, but it has been so hidden that it has failed to reach the notice of Westerners until now. My guest, Swedish journalist Jenny Nordberg, discovered it when she went to Afghanistan to see if the U.S. presence there had improved the lot of women. She found some progress had been made in some places, but it was uneven and fragile. Afghan girls and women still face extreme violence and subjugation and are denied education and employment. But the practice of bacha push shows that even in such a misogynist society, women have found ways to resist. Her book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, tells the stories of these girls and what happens to them when they get older. Jenny Nordberg is an award-winning foreign correspondent and columnist based in New York and a former radio and television producer. Jenny Nordberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Underground Girls of Kabul is about the practice of turning mostly prepubescent girls into boys in the social sense in Afghanistan. It's called bacha posh, is that correct?
Yes, it means literally dressed up like a boy in Dari, one of Afghanistan's languages.
You first became aware of this practice when you went to interview an Afghan politician, a woman parliamentary delegate, in her home. Tell us what happened.
I had come to Afghanistan to do research on Afghan women for a documentary piece, and this woman invited me to her house. And as I arrived, she had to take a phone call in the other room, and I spoke to her 10-year-old twin daughters, who spoke a little bit of English, so they practiced on me. And we had a very basic conversation going in terms of, you know, what's your favorite flower? What are you going to be when you grow up? And then all of a sudden, one of them says to me, and this is a 10-year-old girl, she says, "You know, our brother is really a girl." And I go, "Uh-huh, okay." And then the other one says, "No, really, he's our sister." And at that point, I knew there was a young boy in the family, a 6-year-old, but I hadn't met him yet. And then a few moments later, this 6-year-old, to me, a boy, shows up looking just like his sisters, but with a short haircut, a pair of pants, a denim shirt, much of a boyish attitude, hips forward, not as girly as his older sisters. And I thought, you know, I have no idea. Is this something that goes on in Afghanistan? Is this something that they do? Did I just not do my homework right? But to me, it looked completely like a boy. So I decided to say nothing because I wasn't sure what to say.
So you said nothing, but you pursued this. You asked around, and what happened?
Well, it turned out that every single Afghan knew someone. They were like, oh, yes, you know, someone in my extended family was a girl who used to grow up as a boy. I had a great grandmother who rode horses and shot guns. There's one in my children's school. We have one in the neighborhood. So they all seemed to be aware of something that was almost like a practice that was going on just under the surface in Afghanistan. But then when I consulted all the experts on Afghanistan, they did not know what I was talking about. So there was a little bit of a crazy moment there where I wasn't sure what I was doing.
So why does this happen? What is the purpose behind it?
Well, it's an ancient practice that is as strange as you may think. It also makes a certain kind of sense because being born a girl in Afghanistan is considered to be the absolute worst place on earth to arrive as a little girl because you essentially have very little value. The only value you do have to your parents and to society is that you'll be married off to a husband of your parents' choice, forcibly married at a bride price where you're supposed to have children and sons, ideally, of your own. And before then, little girls are mostly not prioritized when it comes to getting an education. She will make very few decisions of her own in life, and she is entirely under the rule of her father and later her husband. This is like an extreme segregation that goes on in Afghanistan. And then when you segregate two genders, as in this case, there will always be those who try and come over to the other side. So parents do it for a lot of reasons. It's to enhance the prestige of a family, because if you don't have any sons, you're not only seen as weak, you are weak. There's no functioning state. The only things you have going for you would be your sons, who will take care of you when you grow old, who can work outside the family and bring an income. So as a practical matter, you may dress a daughter as a son also for the girl to work and support the family, to be able to get an education when it's too dangerous or too difficult to get to a school. It might be easier in the disguise of a boy. And there's also a magical component to this sometimes when parents believe that one, when you have something that looks like a son in the family, that will eventually also bring a real son into the family. So all these reasons, they're different for each family, but what they all have in common, these families, in this not uncommon practice, is this desperate, desperate need for a son in the family.
Now, when we went into Afghanistan, you know, right after 9/11, one of the justifications, other than getting Osama bin Laden, was to change the position of Afghan girls. What's happened since then? Has anything changed for the better?
Well, that was the story, the original story that I came into research in Afghanistan when I stumbled upon this other story. And I realized that I could use this story of Bachapush, of girls dressing as boys, as a window into exactly that. What has been going on? Has anything changed for Afghan women and girls? And right away, Afghan women told me even there are changes, there have been progress on an individual level. Mostly those are contained to urban areas where women have been able to some degree, to get an education, to work. There have been more little girls in school. But on a larger scale, things have not changed significantly for women there. There have been multiple gender projects in Afghanistan that have been having so many gender experts in the past decade trying to change things around on a larger scale. But that, unfortunately, hasn't really happened. What the human rights organizations say now is that progress has been modest and it's easily reversible. Now is a very dangerous and difficult time, this transition when we're actually pulling out. So if you were to generously say that we, as the Western world, maybe through military and aid and diplomacy intervention there, have been able to provide a little bit of a window, a breathing room for women in the urban areas, no one really knows what's going to happen to that now. And in the rural parts of the country, things have mostly stayed the same. So what you would think of as a horrible treatment of women under the Taliban, for instance, yes, that has changed to some extent, but it was not imposed by the Taliban to begin with, this thing that, you know, women are entirely under the spell of their fathers and their husbands and have very few rights. Those are traditions that go deep, deep in Afghan society, and they remain, and they were there before the Taliban.
And does Bachapush, is it an old practice?
I believe so. There's no written record of this that I have found, but much of Afghanistan is in oral history. So I have been told by many people that they have this going far back in their families, passing them on almost as legends. There are also some parallels to a pre-Islamic time even. I mean, I think that this, as I said, it makes a certain kind of sense. Once you start to segregate society in a severe way, which has been going on for a very, very long time, wouldn't there be some trying to get over on the other side? It's more of a human phenomenon almost, which I think we can also relate to in our own history of what women have tried to do when women couldn't get an education, they couldn't enlist in the army. We have many, many examples of this in our own history as well.
You subtitle your book, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. So you see it as actually a resistance or is it just a way to release the pressure? In other words, a way for resistance not to develop, to kind of accommodate a situation that's so difficult?
I think it's both. I think it's a story of both concession to an impossible society, but there's also a little bit of resistance. There's an element of resistance in this. And I spent years trying to, as we do as humans, trying to come up with the answer. Is this good or bad? Does this mean freedom or is it suppression? You know, suppressing people even more by having little girls pose as boys. And I think that what I eventually came up with is that it's not for me to say, it's not for us to say. And there are certainly elements of hard child labor, for instance, when you'll send a little girl out to work as a boy. I mean, there's nothing about freedom there. There's nothing liberating about that. It's a tragedy. But then you also have these girls, and I've interviewed quite a few adult women too who've had this experience, who speak of difficult consequences of living on the other side when you have to go back, but also that it did provide them with a sense of confidence, that they knew that they were equal to men, they could look men in the eye, and that they were able, their minds were just as good, and that they should have similar rights. So you'll find all of this in the same story.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Jenny Nordberg about her wonderful book. It's called The Underground Girls of Kabul. You've talked a little bit now about the impact on girls. However, I believe from your book, although there are those who continue the practice into adulthood, the idea is to turn them back into girls once they hit puberty. What is the impact on these kids when they face having to go back into the confines of being a woman in Afghanistan?
Well, that is when things get interesting and very, very difficult, because this is largely an uncontroversial practice in Afghanistan. Everybody knows about it. You may not do it to your own child. But again, that's exactly the point. It's about children. So as soon as a woman comes of age, particularly when she begins to menstruate and can conceive and have children, then she becomes a commodity, and it's very important to shelter her. She then carries the honor of her family with her. So to have her running around, even if it's in disguise, with boys, playing football, being outside, riding a bike, is unacceptable. So the agreement, the unspoken agreement almost in Afghan society, is that you turn your daughters back, so to speak, to a gender that they may never have known, to girls before they enter puberty. So to answer the question about what the consequences are, it depends on how far you push it, I would say. I mean, this is anecdotal, but it's what I have. The women that I've interviewed in adult age who had a few years of this experience, they were bachapush as little children, they will largely describe it as confusing to them. They didn't like it. It was unfortunate. And the curtain came down. They had to spend much more time indoors. But that they adopted to that, and that they learned to live with it, and that it gave them some kind of strength and sense of security and confidence later in life. Those who go into puberty as the other gender, as young men, essentially, they describe something far more complicated, as though the other gender stayed with them, that they will never quite be able to shake that off. They have impulses that are traditionally male in Afghanistan. And again, you have to put this in perspective of, in a deeply segregated society, women do certain things and men do other things. It's just polar opposites. It's not like we would, you know, perhaps women can also be engineers, or women will have a rowdy laugh, or women will run. It's not like that. So all of those things are considered traditionally male and very masculine in Afghanistan. And these women who have pushed it into and maybe throughout puberty even, they describe something that's very sad, that they're stuck in a hinterland almost between the two genders.
In fact, you went to one village where there was a woman who was Bachaposh, who was called Uncle. She was actually a kind of go-between the sexes.
Well, this is one example of how remaining in male disguise may be practical for a woman there, and how that would happen. So this was an adult woman who served as an honorary man in her village almost, and that had a very practical purpose because she would be able to speak with the women to pass some of their concerns to the men and vice versa. She could escort the women when they traveled, so it wouldn't take another man, which is otherwise mandatory. So the women who do live as men in adult age, and there are a few, although this is much more rare than the Bachaposh practice, there's usually a practical purpose like that. And some of those women that I've interviewed, they describe themselves as men. They have become men. They have passed onto the other side.
There's a woman you interview who is kind of like this, Shukriya. And you asked her a very interesting question. You asked her to teach you how to be a man. What did she answer?
Oh, yes. She said, "There's nothing I can teach you because you're a man already." And there I was in my silk tunic and my ponytail and thinking I was kind of feminine. But she was like, "No, no, no. You walk fast. You demand things of people. Your whole body language is like that of a man. You look men in the eye. You think you're going to get what you want. And you don't wear any makeup or jewelry." So again, when you segregate, these details become very important. And she had to retrain herself after living like a boy and a young man for 20 years. She had to then study women in order to be able to more resemble them. So she had a very good grasp of what's male and what's female. And in her view, looking at me as a Western woman and as a visitor, there was nothing much feminine about me.
Mm. So what happens to the idea of being human when a society is divided so strictly into genders? Mm-hmm. I mean, the one thing, you know, in our society, we talk about men and women, we certainly have gender roles, but we also have another concept is that we're human and we share a common humanity. What is it like in a culture? Does that fall away? Do they have a concept of common humanity, or is it just the definition of gender?
That's what's fascinating about the Bachaposh practice to me and why I decided to write this book, because when you have such an extreme gender segregated apartheid society, where you can still experiment and turn little girls into boys and women will live like men, at the same time, gender matters less there. Afghans actually taught me a lot about gender. You know, I would come to them and say, "Oh, but you know, what about the right to be a little girl?" And they would say, "Well, what does that mean? What do you put in that? Why is gender so important to you, Jenny?" And I was like, "Well, you know, I didn't think that I would get that lecture." But many times they broaden the idea of being human to me, especially Afghan women. I would ask them, "Okay, so tell me, what's the difference between men and women?" And Afghan women, both who had been Bachaposh and just women, said to me, "Well, the difference between men and women is freedom." And then, of course, I didn't get it at first. I was like, "Well, what else would you think would be different?" Thinking that you get many things from, let's say, an American or a European teenager about that. And they looked at me and they said, "Well, nothing much else. That's the difference. One has it, the other one doesn't." So they know that they're very much human. They know that they're very much equal to men. They're very much aware of how unfair this system is, how dysfunctional this system is, and that they're no less valuable than men. And they're also progressive Afghan men who are of exactly that opinion too, who will fight for their daughters to get an education, who will refuse to impose some of society's strict norms for their own daughters. And those are the very interesting men in Afghanistan. And sometimes also those fathers will allow their bacha-push daughters to push it a little further because they say, well, this is a society that's not working very well. And if you want to dress like a boy to get around, I encourage that.
So in other words, you're saying that they really understand that gender is a social construct.
Well, certainly those who have had the bacha-push experience would think of it as a social construct because they've been through this. They may have been born with one sex. They grew up as the other gender. They may have reverted back than to women. So they've certainly been through a whole journey of this. But then also gender, I think, is important to remember that it's so tied into law and religion and custom and rules. So when you decide that women's brains are weaker because they menstruate, for instance, this may come from a religious leader in Afghanistan or someone very conservative. This is why you can't go to school. Your uterus might just fall out. So then what do you attribute that to? Nature, nurture, religion, some old men who decided something, folklore, a misunderstanding. So all these things go into the definition of gender in Afghanistan.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with investigative journalist Jenny Nordberg about her groundbreaking book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, out from Crown Publishers. You start the story with that young 6-year-old girl who's a bacha-posh, Mehran is his name. I have to say, there was an essay in the New York Times that had photographs of him, and he was just, very compelling. She was very compelling. You also go pretty deeply into the story of her mother, which is a fascinating one, someone who was brought up with a father who was much more open-minded about this, and then found herself in a very difficult situation, who had been a bacha-posh herself at some point. Tell us her story.
Yes, Azita. She is, I would say, the main character in the book where we follow her and we come back to her in her trials over a few years. She was brought up in Kabul. Her father was a university professor under what she calls the Russian time, which is a brutal war in Afghanistan. But then in Kabul, where there was communist rule to begin with, that was a little bit of a charmed childhood for her because she went to an elite school. They taught her Russian. They wanted to invest in her as the next generation of leaders in Moscow, essentially. And the Russians very much set out to educate Afghan women, to liberate them, so to speak, to provide professional opportunities for women. So she grew up in that environment. And then the Soviet Union pulled out of Afghanistan. There was civil war. The government crumbled. The family fled. The father took her to his home province in the northwest of Afghanistan, a very rural province. And that's when also the Taliban came to rule most of Afghanistan. And he then eventually made a decision for his oldest daughter, which was that she was to marry her first cousin. In a time of extreme insecurity, he decided that that was the best call. He was afraid that she was going to be abducted. The family, again, was weak. They did have a young son at that point, but he wanted to introduce another male into the family, essentially, and then do this with his daughter. So Azita found herself then, after having a Kabul upbringing and an education, she found herself in an extremely rural village with no water, no electricity, in a mud hut, essentially. I've been there. To this man that she didn't want to marry. And she was beaten by her mother-in-law. She eventually bore 4 children, all daughters. The irony of that. They were very disappointed because she had been brought in to bring sons into the family, of course. So then when the United States and allies came into Afghanistan and removed the Taliban regime, Azita still saw some opportunity in that. So she taught herself English. She began to work as a translator. She got a little bit of a reputation as an educated woman in her province, and she provided small services and health care for people. So when the new government was instituted in Kabul after the fall of the Taliban, and largely by us, there was a 25% mandate of women. So on that quota, she ran for parliament. She borrowed money and she filed the application and she was elected. So she then convinced her husband that this would provide for the whole family, her salary, and that they would go to Kabul. So she then came back to Kabul many years later as a parliamentarian.
She did that for a couple of years, then she had to run again. Talk about the difficulties for women. I mean, I think 25% is probably more women than we have in the U.S. Senate. However, it was not easy to get reelected. She still had to deal with a whole structure, in fact, a structure that was fairly corrupt. So I wonder if you could talk about how corruption in Afghan politics, how that's been promoted and enhanced in some way by our presence there. And what happened to Azita?
Well, Azita then came back to Kabul with the great hopes of changing her country, of contributing. This was another chance as she saw it for her. I mean, she was now married to this man, but she thought that she would make it work and provide also a better future for her four daughters. So she came in as an idealist. Things were not perfect. She was immediately criticized for not having a son. So how much could she be trusted as a politician even? This is when she decided to turn her youngest daughter into a boy to the outside world. And then she struggled. She tried to be efficient as a politician. It turned out that most of the women quota constitute mostly of either placeholders for warlords who have put in their people there. So women who don't speak, essentially, and do very little. And then women who have a powerful family legacy and can actually execute some change through that. Azita falls somewhere in the middle, I would say. She's middle class. She has no money. She has no strong family behind her. And in that, it was very hard to have anything happen for her. She lost her re-election bid. She was elected in 2005 and she remained until 2010. And then she lost the re-election bid. That was an extremely fraught election where she was eventually recognized as having won the most votes. But it was just such extreme corruption that the parliament was installed before that was even sorted out, with the blessing of the United Nations and the European Union and the Americans as well. So not to go into too much detail about that, but she was the righteous winner. But I think her story also goes to show how, you know, how extremely dysfunctional politics are there still. It's a war economy that's been propped up by foreign powers for the past decade. Everything is about money. Everything can be bought. She was offered to buy back her seat in parliament. She refused. And she was told, well, what's the problem with you? I mean, this is how it's done. So, you know, Afghanistan has had a history of this. And not to say that there are not very many honest Afghans who detest and despise this. A lot of aid money has been pillaged and disappeared, which is infuriating. When you stand in a refugee camp just outside Kabul or in Kabul even, where little children freeze to death every year, while, you know, NATO and the UN and the European Union have wild parties a few blocks away. I mean, that is insane. You just don't understand how that can happen, that we haven't done better in that sense. But it's billions of dollars, and it was politics. And in that, I think, I mean, I don't want to completely dismiss the Afghan politics either, in the sense that, you know, it is a parliamentary system. There's been a peaceful transition now to a new president, so you have to keep some faith in that. But it certainly was very different from young Azita, who as I think she was 33 when she entered parliament, came in with all this idealism and wanting to do things right, very proud to be a woman representing her province. She also quickly found out that this, you know, the women's quota was something that foreigners loved. Foreigners would come in and, you know, want to visit her and speak to her, but then she wouldn't get much respect from her male colleagues many times. So in that sense, the symbolism was very important and is still, but it didn't mean that those women actually had much influence in parliament, unfortunately.
So what would happen if women, if it were different, if she had been able to make a change, if women actually, their 25% could create real change if there were not this corruption, but the UN and the aid agencies were really doing what their mission was supposed to do. What would changing the position of Afghan women, creating more equality for them, what would it do for Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, I think that the I spoke to a U.S. general the other day, and he said that he had told President Karzai once, "Do you really want to keep half your team on the bench?" Which I thought was a nice American sports metaphor. So I think you have to consider that this is a country that's been at war for almost four decades. There's extreme poverty. There's most of the population, up to 90% in some areas, is illiterate. So what you need in terms of changing things for women is that you need to change things for everyone. You need bridges that work. You need roads for transportation. You need all these things. You need some kind of sense of security. It's not just about going in and helping women and then everything will change. I mean, the best way to grasp this is to look at our own history when women, for instance, were able to get an education. I mean, that's how it starts, for instance. Then they're allowed to maybe get a higher education, or they steal a higher education. They then force themselves into the labor market. Through that, they might be able then to get an income, even to support a family. What happens then is that they'll be more valuable as professional women and independent women to some degree than as brides and bride material. So when women gain some financial power, and again, looking at our own history, they will eventually be able to gain some actual political power. And when they gain that power, they'll say, well, I don't want to get married. I don't want to get married now. I don't want to have children right now. I want to decide on my own. They will then gain some control over their own bodies. That's when a country takes off. That's when something happens. And this is what's happened in our societies too. I think that's the path that Afghanistan's going to go in. And it has nothing to do with religion or a culture that must always be fixed. It has to do with power and it has to do with money. And those who have power and have money, they never want to give it away voluntarily. And I think we can see that in our own time as well, and in our own politics, there will always be those who want to control women's bodies and control the origin of life and have ideas of what women can and cannot do. So I think that as much as we talk about this, I think what also stayed with me is when Azita said, she was complaining about the foreigners who were so interested in speaking to her, but she wasn't really sure how they would help her. She said, you know, they think it's all about the burqa and liberating us from the burqa. I would wear two burqas if I could have security and rule of law.
Well, Jenny Nordberg, this is a terrific book and has been a fascinating conversation about it. The book is The Underground Girls of Kabul. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jenny Nordberg is an award-winning foreign correspondent and columnist based in New York and a former radio and television producer. You can find links to her website, bachaposh.com, as well as a link to an excerpt from The Underground Girls of Kabul at writersvoice.net. Next up, protecting access to safe legal abortions. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the U.S., one in three women have had at least one abortion by the time they reach menopause. But in the last few years, more than 200 state laws have passed restricting women's access to safe legal abortions. When presidential hopefuls like Scott Walker can officially oppose abortion even in cases of rape or incest, it's an indication of just how threatened a woman's right to choose has become. And it's not just abortion. Access to contraception is also under threat, and women are being jailed for having miscarriages. Yet the pro-choice movement seems to be reeling back in a defensive posture, with such slogans as abortion should be legal and rare. My guest, Katha Pollitt, says it's time to defend reproductive choice, not only as a moral right, but as a social good, as something that promotes the health of both women and their families. Her book, Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights, is a powerful clarion call to women and their allies everywhere to protect women's right to self-determination. Katha Pollitt is a feminist poet, essayist, and critic. She writes the bi-monthly column, Subject to Debate, for The Nation magazine. Her writing has appeared in such venues as The New Yorker, Harper's, and The Atlantic, among others. Katha Pollitt, welcome to Writer's Voice. In Pro, Reclaiming Abortion Rights. First of all, I have to say I was thrilled to read this book. It felt like a clarion call to finally saying the things that so many pro-choice people have been afraid to say for so many years. You say you wrote the book because you wanted to put women back into the center of the abortion debate. We're not at the center?
No, I think they've been nudged off stage by the, quote, fetus, unquote, the unborn. They never say fertilized egg. They never say embryo, although most abortions are actually of embryos. It's always the fetus or the unborn child. And that's mostly what the debate and discussion revolves around.
And yet, I'm old enough to remember before Roe versus Wade, when abortion was just legal in certain states, but not the law of the land. At that time, it seems to me women were at the center of it. In fact, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women.
Yes, Roe versus Wade was about the privacy rights of women. And the women's movement at that time was very, very clear about that this was a question of women's health, women's lives, women's ability to lead the kind of life that they chose. It was about poverty. It was about all kinds of things, but it was not about the life of the unborn. That issue was for women to think about privately. And if they thought it was wrong to have an abortion, they shouldn't have one.
You actually say that this construction, however, the construction of abortion that Roe versus Wade, the way it framed it as a right to privacy, was not the best way to frame it. And you frame it differently. You frame it as an issue of equality. Could you talk about what's the difference between privacy and equality in terms of the implications for the right to legal abortions?
I think I don't put it as strongly as you do, the point about privacy and equality. The Roe versus Wade makes the privacy argument, and many people have said, oh, it would have been better if Justice Blackmun had based the right to an abortion on women's equality, that being able to control your childbearing is essential for women to be in the workforce and to, you know, be equal to men. I think there's a lot to be said for that point of view, although I think privacy is also important. I don't see why it couldn't have had two reasons, you know. And he was presented with the equality argument. There were amicus briefs that made that argument, and he picked privacy. And I think he picked privacy because if you read Roe v. Wade, it's very focused on doctors and their rights and on health, and that the privacy argument fits in better with that kind of a framework. But I think that without the right to control your body, you really don't have very many rights at all. At any moment, you can get pregnant, and then at that moment, your entire life is turned upside down. Whether you had voluntary sex, involuntary sex, whatever your state of health, however old you are, all the rest, none of that matters. You're pregnant, so that's what matters. That's a very, very large burden for women and only women to bear as they go through life. What I say in my book, though, is some people say the outcome for abortion rights would have been very different had Roe v. Wade based its argument for legal abortion on equality rather than privacy. And that's what I wonder about, because the anti-abortion movement, I think, would have developed just the same. You know? And the same people who have a problem with privacy for women have a problem with equality for women. And so I don't think it would have been any different in the long run. I think the actual words of Roe v. Wade and the actual arguments of Roe v. Wade matter a lot less than what Roe v. Wade did.
But at least it would have kept the woman at the center of the debate. And one of the things that you do in your book, Katha Pollitt, that you do in Pro, is to show how the pro-choice movement itself has become apologetic about the demands for access to abortion. I wonder if you could talk about how this debate has shifted, how the frame has shifted, and how those who are pro-choice have shifted along with it, and what that has done to the movement, to cede ground to the anti-abortionists.
Right. Well, I would say that when abortion was first legalized, and the emphasis was on women, you found people saying, you know, a popular slogan was abortion on demand and without apology. That framework of not just I have the right to control my body, but I have the right to lead the life I want to lead, and a stray sperm should not get in the way of that. That framework has been replaced by a much more apologetic one, which is, oh, abortion is just, it should be safe, legal, and rare, which was the Clinton mantra. Abortion is, oh, it's the most difficult decision a woman ever makes. And I'm thinking, really? A woman who had no thought or interest in having a baby gets pregnant, and all of a sudden she's seriously thinking to herself, oh, I really should have this baby, but I don't think that's the way it works. And I think that what that framework is about, this new one, is it's trying to placate the growing sense that there's something deeply wrong about abortion, and it has to be legal because women will die if they have to and be injured, if they have to seek illegal procedures. But it's really a terrible thing, and women should feel really bad about it. I think it's an acceptance of stigma.
In fact, you say we need to treat abortion not as rare, but as common. How common is abortion?
Well, abortion is very common, although the number of abortions has been declining for quite some time. But the statistic you often hear is that 1 in 3 women will have had at least one abortion by menopause. And even if the abortion rate goes down and it turns out to be, okay, 1 in 4, that's still a lot of people.
So it's this common, and I can come out and say right now that I'm one of those 1 in 3. In fact, I'm surprised it's not higher. But I think women tend to be quite secret about the numbers of abortions that they have. I wonder if you could talk about that, you know, the pressure to keep this secret.
It's so true. It is just so true. Now, interestingly, my book got a lot of reviews, and in 3 of them, the author said, I had an abortion. And in one of those cases, that woman hadn't told anybody. And I think it is very hard for women to talk about their abortions. And my hope is that the book will encourage people to do that. If you can do that, if you're in a safe place where you can do that, you'd really be helping a lot of women, because since women tend not to talk about this, even sometimes with their closest friends, even with their husbands, then the perception is never challenged that abortion is not just not all that common, but that the people who have abortions, this is important, the people who have abortions are the stereotypical, teenager running wild, the slutty co-ed, 20-somethings who are just selfish and want to have fun, and the most popular one of all, the cold-hearted career woman who hates children. And so there's a perception that, the people who have abortions aren't people like me, an upstanding Christian or a decent person or the mother of several children. And I'll just say by way of parenthesis that now, these days, most women who have abortions are already mothers, which tells you something right there about how these stereotypes don't fit reality.
The stigma that is attendant on it, you turn that around and say not only is it not immoral to have an abortion. But often it is the moral decision. Could you
I think that's really true. I support women, women making their own decision, whatever they do. But I think that there's just no question that it's good to have children when you're in a good place to take care of them. It's not a good idea to have 10 children that you can't pay proper attention to. And it's not a good idea to have children when you're too young or when you need your education or when you already have several children. A lot of women have children that are disabled and their hands are totally full taking care of those children. I think a lot of women have abortions because they're thinking about the children they already have and what those children need and how much the woman has to give to them.
Right. That was certainly true in my case. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the anti-abortion movement. Their policy has been to restrict more and more, to chip away at the rights granted by Roe versus Wade. Talk about the changes in the landscape of access to abortion that has been going on for the last 30 years, and where are we right now?
Well, I'm sure your listeners know that in the last couple of years, there have been a tremendous number of laws passed in the states restricting access to abortion, over 200 in the last 2 years. And this is all related to Republican success in the states and in controlling state legislatures and governorships. And that's why we've seen, for example, so many clinics closed in Texas, and why there is only one abortion clinic left in Missouri, which is a big state, and where they've just passed a 72-hour waiting period. Clinics have closed in Ohio, in Virginia, in North Carolina, in Pennsylvania. I think for a long time people thought, oh, okay, it's North Dakota and South Dakota that, they'd each only have one clinic left, that the success of the pro-life movement has been limited to low-population rural states that are far away from most of the rest of America. But to the extent that it ever was true, it's not true anymore. Now we're seeing that it isn't just in red states where clinics are closing. It's in some pretty purple states, too. So the combination of clinics closing as a result of what are called trap laws, targeted regulation of abortion providers, which are the laws that will typically require a clinic to renovate or remodel in ways that have no bearing on their ability to provide services, but that are very expensive. And that's a way of shutting them down. If you make a clinic do $1 million worth of architectural changes, and also this requirement that doctors have admitting privileges within, 30 miles of the clinic, but then no hospital will give them those admitting privileges. So that's another way of shutting them down. So between the trap laws and the ever-increasing restrictions, it's much harder to get an abortion in much of the country than it was, 10 years ago.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Katha Pollitt about her new book, Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Now, just a little point. I noticed that although in the book you do clarify the issue of what to call the anti-abortion movement, you just referred to them as pro-life.
Right. I use the word pro-life when I'm talking about the political movement that calls itself pro-life. But I try to avoid using that word to describe the ideas of that movement or the individuals. And I try to call them abortion opponents, anti-abortion, words like that, because I don't think they are pro-life. I think that's a propaganda word.
There's one example in the book where they cut support to children who are already born in order to fund these clinics, so-called clinics that
right.
are pushing women.
To fund the crisis pregnancy centers, right. That happens. There's been a big transfer of wealth away from born children to fertilized eggs, embryos, and fetuses. And who thinks that's a good idea?
And so talking about fetuses and embryos, you have a marvelous chapter in the book about what is a person. Talk about that within the context of, what is a person and then is a woman a person? I think to link those two ideas together.
Well, anti-choicers, of course, base a lot on the personhood, the supposed personhood of the fertilized egg, embryo, and fetus. And I look at, well, what do we mean when we say something is someone is a person? We don't mean that they're some DNA, you know? We mean things like they have consciousness, they have arms and legs and a head, they have social relationships, they have all the qualities, or at least some of the qualities that a born person has, that a fertilized egg, for example, does not have. And you can see how this language of personhood, it's very iffy, because the fertilized egg in a woman, it's a person. Even before it's implanted, from the moment of conception, it's a person. But that same fertilized egg in a petri dish, in a fertility clinic, that's not a person. And although there are some anti-abortion people who would say, no, it's a person when it's in the petri dish too, that's never going to get anywhere, because we love fertility medicine in America. That's all about making babies. So if you have to destroy a whole bunch of fertilized eggs and pre-embryos to achieve that worthy goal, that's fine. Fertility doctors don't have to go to work in bulletproof vests. But that just shows you that it's really about women. It's really about women, and it's about sex. That's how that fertilized egg got in that woman is very important.
Well, say more about that. Yeah. What do you mean it's about sex? I mean, it's not just about sex, oh, we love sex. It's about sex in a very different way.
Right. Well, you can see this, too. Most Americans, the very, very large majority of Americans, would say that to have an abortion if you're raped is okay. But to have an abortion when you had voluntary sex, unless there's a serious health problem, is not okay. Well, why is that? From the point of view of the embryo, if an embryo can be said to have a point of view, it's just the same. And yet, for most people, it feels quite different. It's as if they think sex is a kind of contract to have a baby, if a baby is started. What a lot of people are very disturbed by, the separation of sex and reproduction. That just seems like that's where it all went wrong, when people just, you know, all this hedonism, all this wild 60s stuff, people just doing what they want. It's all bad.
But only having to do with women, I mean, I haven't seen anything about trying to control the sexuality of men.
Well, that's true. And you do wonder, well, how would that be done, right? I mean, how would that happen? They would say, well, he has to pay child support. But child support is nothing like having to risk your health and life and your social position and all your hopes and dreams in pregnancy and childbirth. There's just no comparison there. And it's also the woman, too, has to pay child support to herself, right? I mean, there aren't that many men who are bearing the full 50% cost of raising a child to adulthood. And there are many, many who pay nothing. So it's about controlling women's sexuality. And I do think that that is what a lot of the anti-abortion movement is all about.
Do you actually say the aim is really not just to make abortion illegal? In fact, that the agenda goes far beyond that, and it's really not even about that.
Well, yeah, birth control. I mean, this is a really fascinating thing. When pro-choicers started saying, you know, they're coming for your birth control too, this was widely poo-pooed in the mainstream media, sort of like, oh, these pro-choicers, they're always such hysterics. You know, it's always Chicken Little with the sky falling. But, you know, time passes, and now you can see it's really true. When all this defunding of Planned Parenthood means less access to birth control, flat funding for Title X, which is the federal program that provides birth control to poor women. And then a very interesting feature is the way more and more the pro-life movement is trying to make a case that birth control is actually a form of abortion. So, for example, emergency contraception causes an abortion, which is not true. It prevents ovulation. It will not interfere with an established pregnancy, and it doesn't even apparently prevent implantation. It prevents ovulation. But they don't accept that science. They have their own facts. the birth control pill, more abortion, the IUD, abortion. And I'm thinking, why aren't they happy that the vast majority of studies and science and medicine say these things are not abortions? Why aren't they saying, well, this is great. Here's the wonderful compromise. We're against abortion, but we love birth control. But they don't say that. They say we're against abortion and birth control is another form of abortion. So that's where you can see that there's a real anti-women sexuality component in all this.
You know, this puts me in mind of The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood's prescient novel. And yet, even with all that we've been talking about, the legal right to abortion still remains in the polls, overwhelmingly supported by the American people. Do we risk getting to The Handmaid's Tale or something like that? Your book is aimed at the muddled middle, you say. I mean, obviously, people like myself and like you are very clear about the necessity of keeping abortion legal. What has to happen to really build a movement that can support the rights that a vast majority of American women and men support?
Well, I don't think we're going to end up with The Handmaid's Tale version of life. I think women have come much too far to be turned back and confined in that way. I think we might see abortion not available in a lot of red states and in a lot of areas in blue states. But there are states where abortion rights are very popular. For example, New York and California. But we might see that abortion, you can't get an abortion in the middle of the country. You know, you can get an abortion on the coasts and maybe a few big cities in between, like Chicago. But basically, it will be very hard to get. And I could also see abortion being made much harder to get than it already is after the first trimester, because these polls depend a lot on how you ask the question. If you ask the question, do you agree with the Roe v. Wade decision, which made abortion legal through most of pregnancy, people will say, yes, I agree with that. But if you ask them, you know, well, what about abortion in the second trimester? That support falls way off. What about abortion in the third trimester? Almost nobody's in favor of that. And one of the things I talk about in my book is people don't really know what all these things mean. Like, they don't know that it's, you know, there are like three places in the whole country where you can get a third trimester abortion, and which are usually for pretty serious reasons. Now, you ask about how can we have a strong pro-choice movement. And I would say, you know, my hope is that it's already starting. I think with the youngest cohort of activists, we are seeing a vigor and energy and in-your-faceness that is something quite fresh. And that's really great. For example, you see women tweeting their abortions, filming their abortions, refusing to accept that whole stigmatized framework. You see new organizations that are fighting stigma, which I think is an essential step. You know, you're not going to get people mobilized around this issue as long as they feel ashamed of what they've done. So there's a new organization called Sea Change that organizes book clubs to discuss an anthology that they've put together of stories about all aspects of reproduction written by all sorts of women. And then the women in the book club talk about it. And what often comes out is how many of them have had abortions and how they feel about it. And that's huge.
Well, Kath Hippolyte, I want to thank you so much for writing this book. It's actually a terrific read. I just found myself on the subway going, yes!
Oh, that makes me so happy.
It's called Pro, and I urge all my listeners, male and female alike, to go out and get it. And thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that was Kath Hippolyte. You can read an excerpt to Pro by going to writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.